Even in the relative cool of the early morning, sweat rapidly began to mingle with the dust kicked up by 10,000 pairs of feet, half blinding the advancing hoplites and stinging their blinking eyes, so that their vision of the enemy ahead of them, the outlandishly dressed archers reaching for their arrows, the slingers for their shot, the expressions of glee and disbelief in the Persian ranks, grew ever more obscured. Soon the first arrows began to hiss down upon them. Then, raising the monstrous weight of their shields to protect their chests, the hoplites began to run. Simultaneously, as though the phalanx were some ferocious cornered creature, stiffening its bristles as it turns to face its foe, those in the front three ranks lowered and aimed their spears in preparation for the coming collision. By now, with some 150 yards still to travel, a storm cloud of arrows and slingshot was breaking over them, thudding into their shields, bouncing off their helmets, striking the odd hoplite in the thigh or through the throat, but still the Athenians, braving the black rain, only quickened their pace. Those of the enemy directly in their path had already begun scrabbling to erect wicker defences as they realised, to their horror, that the wall of shields and iron-tipped spears, far from providing easy pickings for their bowmen, as they had at first imagined, was not going to be halted. Then, as the Athenians' war cry, a terrifying ululation, rose even above the thundering of their feet upon the dry earth, the cacophony of clattering metal, and the screams of the panic-stricken enemy, the phalanx crunched into the Persian lines. The impact was devastating. The Athenians had honed their style of warfare in combat with other phalanxes, wooden shields smashing against wooden shields, iron spear tips clattering against breastplates of bronze. Now, though, in those first terrible seconds of collision, there was nothing but a pulverizing crash of metal into flesh and bone. Then a rolling of the Athenian tide over men wearing, at most, quilted jerkins for protection. The hoplites' ash spears, rather than shivering, as invariably happened when one phalanx crashed into another, could instead stab and stab again. And those of the enemy who avoided their fearful jabbing might easily be crushed to death beneath the sheer weight of the advancing men of bronze. Soon, on the wings of the Persian army, men were breaking in terror, streaming back across the plain, as the Athenians, skewering and hacking, continued their deadly work. Only in the centre, where the force of the phalanx's impact had been much weaker, did the invaders have the better of the fight, withstanding the collision and then slowly pushing the hoplites back. Here was where the invaders' best troops had been stationed. The Persians themselves, more heavily armoured than most of the other levies, and the Sarca, brutal fighters from the far-off eastern steppes, their axes perfectly capable of cleaving a hoplite's helmet. Yet already the Athenian wings were wheeling inwards, attacking them on their flanks, reinforcing the hard-pressed tribesmen of Aristeides and Themistocles, so that soon the Persian centre too began to crumple and the slaughter grew even more incarnadine. It was then that the few Persians and Sarca who were left joined the general rout and fled for their ships. Yet if the battle was won, the victory was still far from decisive. Callimachus, the war archon, was also killed. So too one of the tribal generals. 7 Persian ships were ultimately secured, but all the rest succeeded in pulling away. The road to Athens may have been blocked to the Persians, but not the sea. And what of the ships containing the cavalry that had embarked before the battle? Consternation swept through the ranks. 26 miles away, their families and homes lay undefended. Exhausted, sweat-soaked, and blood-streaked, they had no choice but to head back at once for Athens as fast as their legs could take them. It was not yet 10 in the morning when they left the battlefield. By late afternoon, in an astounding display of toughness and endurance, they had reached their city. In the nick of time, too, for soon afterwards the first ships of the Persian fleet began to glide towards Phalerum. For a few hours they lay stationary beyond the harbour entrance. Then, as the sun set at last on that long and fateful day, they sailed eastwards into the night. The threat of invasion was over. So it was that Athens proved herself, in the ringing words of Miltiades, a city fit to become the greatest of all in Greece. Even the Spartans, when they arrived there after their grueling three-day march, regarded the men who had conquered the Persians unaided with a new and ungrudging respect. Marching onwards to inspect the battlefield, they found at Marathon evidence enough of the scale of the menace that had been turned back so heroically. 6,400 invaders lay there, fattening the flies. The Athenians, as they would never tire of reminding everyone, had shown that the hordes of the great king, Darius, could be defeated. Liberty might be defended after all.